conversation with Miss Norton, Miss Wheeler, Mr. Blair. Continue. You were saying, once you were changing tape, Miss Thornton, that America at least offered some theoretical background for the improvement of society. Is that right?
Yes.
That accepting it?
Yes, that's quite true. And I was also saying that if the American black man does in fact achieve his goals, yeah, I think it actually strengthens the theories when the nation was founded. Also, it strengthens, might strengthen what people are now talking of in terms of a lost ideology or lost ideals, lost goals. In fact, it might even help to reiterate what we have always claimed to be true, or what we've always said is the nation's basis for existence. It might help, in fact, to bring America into the greatness which it truly could have in our modern times, as far as world leadership is concerned, as far as the realization, as far as self-realization is concerned, on an international level.
You mean the civil rights movement has the possibility of provoking some moral regeneration in American society in general? Is that,
yes.
Paraphrases that?
This I believe very, very strongly.
Miss Wheeler, you had something to say a moment ago.
I'm especially concerned about, it was a good while ago, the idea that there were good or bad white people in the South, or courageous or not courageous Negroes and so on. The whole idea of conceptualizing people and leaving it at that. And what I want to say is that both sides, because I'm calling it conflict between black and white people, both sides of the conflict use this idea of a mysterious unwillingness to change on the part of the other one to such an extent that often it obscures, I think, their own ends and hurts. Now,
could you be specific on that point,
yeah,
please? An illustration.
Yeah. I think that for me to say that the white Southern man has such a deep hatred for me that it will never change. Look, he would rather move out of town and live in a segregated town or let his child go to a... I'm sorry, live in a desegregated town or let his child go to an integrated school. I think when I do that, I'm giving, making him so mysterious that I don't even approach... the possibility of me approaching him has been lessened by the mystery that I surround him with.
As you have given him a stereotype, too,
yeah,
is that it?
Yeah, and I think similarly, we are stereotypes. You know, I think everyone
indeed
knows
you
the general stereotype.
Absolutely.
Now, what I'm trying to say is that on both sides, the stereotype has to go because it blinds us to avenues of action. That is, as long as I'm sitting in the corner wondering why he hates me, I'm not going to say, well, whether he hates me or not, he does want to keep his business open. Whether he hates me or not, he does want his child to get educated in some school. Now, I think that when we start recognizing that we are being too mysterious about the whole thing, this is an idea which Howard Zinn puts forth in The American Scholar a couple months ago. When we recognize that we're being so mysterious about the whole thing that we are losing track of what we're doing, and get back and get onto a track of making the white man choose what's most important to him. And I imagine it would go the other way around, except I'm more sympathetic, you know, in my direction.
You're stuck with that.
Yeah. then I think we'll put ourselves into a better bargaining position. And when we do get to that glorious time when we have a problem of how to relate to white people in the South, and I think that'll be a long way away, then we won't have that mysterious cloak hanging around, and Howard Zinn calls it the Southern mystique, that won't even allow us to approach him.
Let me refer to an article written some years ago in about 55 or 6 by Carl Rowan, and in conversation at the same time, same period, he said the same thing. That all the trouble in the South might be a dress rehearsal for the big show in the North.
I do understand.
I understand it.
I'll agree with that.
Oh, really?
The real, the big trouble, the big trouble of integration would come in the North.
Right.
The Southern situation was a dress rehearsal, or might turn out to be a mere dress rehearsal, for the big problem when the real trouble starts.
In other words,
this is 10 years
the
ago.
More subtle problems that you have in the North, really. What happens on stage down south, in a sense.
I think he was referring to actual violence.
That's right.
Well, potentially in the North.
More so than...
I think that's what you meant.
I'm agreeing with that. He told Blair.
Yes, Mr. Blair.
I agree that that what's going on in the South now is actually a preview of what might happen in the North. As a result of more Negroes now living in the North and Western areas of the United States than in the South. I think only about, in the last 10 years, or since 1941, about 51% of the Negroes live outside the South nowadays. And most of them live in the North. Most of them who come from the South are not educated. They don't have a college degree. They've gone to the North with the idea of the glorious North, of the Canaan land, where opportunities are bright. And going there, they find out this is only just a reverse. In many instances, it's worse than what's in the South. And they're having to face up to realities now. And even with Negroes having the right to public accommodations and so forth in the North, they still have to face the problem of getting equal job employment on the basis of their ability to do a job, and also living in getting decent housing, which in de facto, actually in reality, there is still segregated housing. And so many of them can't face up to this problem. Many of them can't meet up to the educational standards which they needed to get decent jobs. And so you can't expect in cities like Chicago, Washington, New York, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, and many other cities of this nature, within the next 10 years, an overpopulation is still growing of the population of Negro citizens. And as a result of this, you can expect there to be more racial, I think, more racial imbalance and more racial conflict than there is in the South. I may be wrong in what I'm saying, but I'd be willing to bet my top dollar on this. And I can say you can expect violence, at least more violence in the North than you can in the South.
Let me say something. I think that it's right that the Negro in the North is not... in any kind of paradise. I think the Negro has a bad time in the North because he's a Negro. But I think that you have to admit basic differences between the North and the South, and they tend to get obscured when people start talking about how when they went up there they lived in the ghetto and so on. I think that the fact that a judge in Chicago couldn't give a girl 18 months in jail and 12 months of hard labor for whatever it was, trespassing or permit, I can't remember the charge, I don't think he could get away with it in Chicago.
That's a real distinction, isn't it?
I think it's a very basic distinction. I think it's a distinction between a person being a person when he comes into court and a person being a block of skin when he comes into court. When you arrest a Negro arrested in the South, is a Negro who's going to pay a fine and go to jail. You know that.
Alas, it's not true in the North either. Sometimes it is. But take the Reed case in Connecticut.
I agree, it happened. But I think it couldn't have been raised with the idea that I was just as good as the man next, he lived a block away. I couldn't have been raised with the idea that there was no difference between me and him if I hadn't lived in the North, I would think. It never occurred to me that I was a Negro, that being a Negro meant anything until I came to Washington and and people started talking about it. Now, I'm not trying to say the North is wonderful. I'm just saying there's a basic difference between the North and the South. And what I want to say further is that the conflict you're talking about, the violent conflict and so on, if it comes, it's going to be a nation conflict, not just North. I think South are trying to do is get up. You might say the Negroes in the South would like to get up at least to the level that the Negroes in the North are. And then we can all fight it out. But I don't believe it's going to be peculiar to the North.
No, I've been realizing that Negroes in the last decade or so, or since World War II, have drifted toward the city, and that Negroes have sought the city as a refuge from suburban life, in which they don't have too much chance as farms and so forth, I realize that a definite problem will be created instead of the problem being ameliorated or the problem lessened. That's going to be more of a problem for Negroes who live in the cities, especially in the large city areas. And that's where most of us are going at Washington, like I said, in Detroit, New York.
What about mechanization of rural areas in the South, in the farms?
Well, Negroes, to a certain extent, aren't attracted to the farms anymore. I think they're going toward
the
cities.
Then the city is a common problem. He's down in the South and the North.
It's a common problem in the South and the North, but in the North, more so to the street than in the South, because Negroes are just beginning to move to the city. And I must admit, in the South now, Negroes have a chance to own something. They have a chance to have something of their own. They have a chance to spread out, to at least own some property and so forth. Whereas in the North, they're still crammed up in the row houses, as I said, in the buildings. Maybe I have a warped idea of the North, but from living here in Washington, D.C.,
I got grass around my house, and I ain't got no money.
I know. Living here in Washington, D.C., and seeing the situation, I cannot view it with much optimism as being the best place for Negroes to live. But, of course, home is home. And I would take a chance. I would live in the South than live in the North. Considering all the situations, and I know Negroes get less payment in the South, but like I said before, I feel that there is a relationship between Negroes and whites when met at the tide or its ebb, that the Negroes and whites in the South will eventually work out their problems better than those in the North. I feel we are 30 years behind what's going on in the North. And eventually, when we reach where the North is now, where the Negroes and the whites are in the North now, that we will have a definite problem to meet. But I think that problem will work out better because we know where we stand, and that the new South, which we'll build up, will be a South. I believe the South will rise again, incidentally.
Oh, wow.
But this time, I believe it'll be with the Negroes and whites on an equal basis solving their problem rather than just one ethnic or racial group being in the forefront.
And I got a criticism.
Go on, Jean. No,
because
when I talk, it'll be a long time.
What I say is we're falling into a trap.
Yeah.
In the same way that nationalism, I think, is a trap for countries trying to achieve world peace. A trap of maintaining the glory of the South or of the productivity and progress of the North is what we've got to, you know. Negroes might end up in. I don't think it's significant that. I mean, I think it's significant that you know you can have a bad time in the North and a bad time in the South. What I'm trying to suggest is that it's the country really, you know. And I don't want to make it that general, but the problem of automation is not the North's problem. It's this country's problem. And with industry coming into the South, which may, I understand now the pattern is to come to one town, take advantage of its tax exemption, so on, and leave and go to another town. People are still jobless. people are going to be jobless when it's all over. The problems are going to be coming to the North and the South. Now, maybe the Civil Rights Movement can speed up the pace at which the South has to face these problems, but I believe that has to be faced on a nationwide scale. And I believe any kind of fight is going to be done, it's going to be done on a nationwide scale, and incidentally, I'm not against fights.
Incidentally, this may not be an interview, but several people have felt that the nonviolent movement is moving from a nonviolent scale to a violent scale. And I want to ask you all this question. Do you feel that the present Negro leadership now can hold off the Negroes any longer from retreating to violence? I mean, like now I'm learning the law that a man who is attacked has the right to attack himself if he is in fear of bodily harm, you know. And now this is a serious situation, no joke. Should Negroes as a whole continue to take the nonviolent step, or should we be like any other ordinary citizen, whites under the law, if he is in fear of bodily harm and if he retreats to walk and can go no further? Should he defend himself? Do you feel that this should happen? Do you feel that we should take maybe it suits in the courts against the restaurant owners of restaurants who use other persons to throw us out physically and maybe injure us, to assault us, or or cause damage or battery to us. I mean, Lucy, Jean, how do you feel about it?
Well, the only problem is I'm going to really go astray. So, Jean, if you want to answer to that immediate problem, I can say this, that...
I got an answer to that.
To the most immediate problem. Okay, good. Then I'll talk about both when I...
I've been reading about revolutions, and I've sort of been disappointed because they're not mass things. the mind of the people doesn't come together and try to right or wrong. And I say, whether any organized violence is going to be led, and we're going to be the ones to lead it. Now, I think there will be a conscious decision to change the tactic. Now, it might not be all the great leaders sitting in one room. But I believe that any change in the approach to the problem that has a wide effect is going to be a conscious decision on the part of the people who take leadership roles, the agitators, and so on. Now, that's us, and that's Martin Luther King, and that's Abernathy, and Wilkins, and so on. So I don't think that we have to worry so much about controlling violence. I think in one town to another, there might be outbreaks that are... to the disadvantage of the movement because, then everybody has trouble in court and so on or whatever. But I think that any large-scale Negro violent movement is going to be organized. It's going to be somebody's fault. So I don't think we have to worry about controlling except for our individual problems with maintaining the organization of the civil rights movement in, Greensboro or where have you.
My comments will probably be more in keeping with what we've talked about for the last 20 minutes of the last half hour, but anyway, I think I'll probably encompass much of what we've been saying, at least what you've said, Izella, and what you've said, Jean. But I'd like to go all the way back to your comments as to what I said to you in November.
I was trying to reconstruct them.
Yes. Back to that, my statements, of course, were very well rephrased by you, but what I had in mind then is a time which is not now, unfortunately. It's a time when we in the South will have reached a point of mediation where Negroes and whites can, in fact, sit down and say, this is how the South will be, or this is
clearly
how...
Clearly not now.
Clearly not now. Right. And I do think that we have some very strong things in our background, which, in fact, could help us to win a kind of victory, which E. Zell has spoken of as being much different from what, say, when we do come up to the level of where Northerners are now, it might be a far better victory than Northerners now, in fact, have, because the kinds of subtle segregation, the kinds of subtle leaving the Negro out of society would not pervade as they do, in fact, now. Getting on, though, that we do, as Jean has alluded to, have problems with the new Negro, in a sense, because there is a large amount of impatience manifest throughout Northern and Southern Negro, because, of course, I guess it's part of the times, really. When a man has fought a couple of wars side by side, and he still doesn't have, when he comes home and there's no peace of mind, he wants to know, what in the devil did I fight for? You've got more and more larger numbers of angry black men, and this is the kind of thing which is not conducive to nonviolence. It's not conducive to the kind of sitting down at a table and working with the basic things which we in fact have, so that this growing impatience, unless things are worked out and worked out quickly, we've got to set gradualism aside and we've got to try to utilize what we in fact do have. And if communication does not, I could say, again open up, or does not reach a better level in the South, we might not ever be able to, without the advent of violence, get to the point where Negroes and whites could sit and, in fact, mediate, come up with solutions coming from a common bond, which they, in fact, do have, or which they might feel towards land. Because now, more and more, you can't blame a man for abandoning something which has never meant anything to him, in the sense that it's always been a curse upon him, or you realize more and more that... the Southern way, everything that I've ever been taught, everything that I've ever felt, believed, has come from something that has cursed me. Now I just want to get away from it as quickly as I can. Some people might still feel I'll stay here and fight, I'll try to change it. But basically, the times are ripe for men standing up and realizing that even though there might be some things that I feel, or there might be a certain amount of understanding in me for what happens or for what doesn't happen here, I'm alive now. I've got to live now. I'm impatient, and I can't wait for this kind of thing. And the more things happen, the further away the kind of victory that I'd like to see, the further away this kind of thing becomes, so that the impatience and the feeling that if it takes violence, okay, so we'll go to that. But these are also the kinds of things which tend to annihilate, really, the two groups. And so that if you don't have, in the South, you don't have some very, very quick communication between the sides, the realization really on one side, which might be right now thinking, well, if it were just a little more gradual, you know, and if they wouldn't raise so much cane, you know, or we're going to give them some things, or it's coming in due time. If instead of that, there were a clear appraisal of what the situation is in the South, and really what the situation is in the nation, and less of the attitude of, well, we're going to fight this tooth and nail, I think that we might really get much further along, not only in our civil rights and in our present race struggles, but as far as the whole nation's growth and welfare is concerned, you know. Yeah.
Oh, I would say I agree with you what you say, Lucy, but you say, I think one of the main stumbling blocks that we have is the moderate in the civil rights struggle. It reached a point
Excuse
now.
Excuse me, the main what?
I think one of the main obstacles that we have is the moderate in the civil rights struggle. He's the one who knelt for violence. You know, he's the one who always wants the community to return to normalcy. But at the same time, he doesn't want justice to prevail within the community. I mean, he is the one. Well, there was a time the moderate was a good fellow. I think we need moderates. But I think at the same time, we need a moderate in the community who's going to say, well, it's about time we come right, you know, for justice. We keep giving the Negroes tokenism and tokenism. And really, even though we ask for desegregation tomorrow and freedom now, this is all we really get is tokenism. Each time, you know, after each movement, we get a little bit each time. Now, I feel this is what the movement is working on, tokenism. But I think unless something is done very seriously, the tokenism won't work. And I think the whole idea of negotiations and everything, to break down racial discrimination in the community on a wide level, on what we call across the board level, is really going to break down. And when this does, I think we can expect the worst. Now, people say I'm a pessimist. I always look for the worst. But I look for the best. I realize, and even in the answer for these across the board across the board desegregation, that we're going to get tokenism each time.
Let me ask you a question, Mr. Blair. If we come to violence, what's the consequence of violence? What is the expectation or hope or prediction for violence?
Well, the way I face it now, the law is definitely against the Negro in the South. Violence will not work for us, even though in many instances it may be the answer to many of the anxieties that Negroes have, many of the frustrations which we have. To really maybe vent our emotions against the whites for the many years.
It would be an emotional expression, but what comes after that expression?
But if we had violence, it would definitely be, I think, be against the movement. Unless there was some outside aid from many countries abroad to the desegregation movement. I don't think we would get this from Panama, from Cuba, from Russia, anybody else. When it comes down to it, Negroes are a prisoner within their own country. And it's really going to be a fight that we have to stand alone. Violence would not work, I don't think. It might work to a limited degree. We might get a limited answer or a solution to our problem. But if we use violence, if we will attack, which we don't have the weapons and everything to do, it will be like a massacre. It will be... We're outnumbered number-wise, we're outnumbered gun-wise, we're outnumbered so far as the law is concerned, because in most communities, in reality, in disregarding the theory concerning the law, the police, which is supposed to be used to secure the community peace, is really used in many instances to uphold segregation.
But you
and
know,
if you look at the North, then and Princess Anne and Cambridge is a good example in Birmingham.
And what I said,
Miss Wheeler,
I know the argument very well that we're outnumbered, that it would be a mass concern, and I agree with it, and would plan in terms of our inability to really put up a good fight. But I say, as soon as you start saying we beat before we started, then the whole the depth of what you're doing has been lessened, because you're not willing to take it all away. I personally am willing to take it all away. If I have to get shot, then I just have to get shot. And I think as long as you say, well, now, when my back is up against the wall, even though I can't win, I'm going to fight anyway. As long as you let the whoever's pushing you up against the wall know that, you have a much better chance of the in-between negotiations winning, and maybe of when you're up against the wall and you stop kicking back. Maybe that'll win too. But I think that as soon as that, at the point at which Negroes start saying, well, we can't win anyway, they're very close to loss.
No, I'm not saying we can't win, Gene. I'm saying that.
I'm saying don't let it color. I mean, let it color, but let your main working base be, I'm in it all the way.
Yeah, I'm in it all the way. It's true. But if violence came and I had no resort but to protect my home and my family, I would have to do this. I'm not, I don't reason the same way Martin Luther King reasons. I reason the whole civil rights movement from a political standpoint of view. I am not a minister, and I don't take the same views that many ministers take, the nonviolent attitude. I think it comes a time when a man has to stand up. And in America, as it was brought out, people respect a man who's brave and who will stand up for a cause. Now, if this leads to violence, then I say let it come. As Frederick Douglass says, those people who would run away from violence, who want social change, might as well be asking for to rain without thunder lightning. It's impossible for crops to grow without rain. It's impossible. You can't help the crops to grow without rain, you see. Or you can't help the sea without its mighty roar. These things are impossible. And so I say, if violence comes, then it comes. I'm here. I'm not going to stray away from it. But I don't advocate the situation.
Yeah, I see. Put that way, I agree.
Yes.
This is the end. This is the end of this tape. No more on this tape. No more on this tape. This is the end. No more on this tape. No more on this tape. Copy. No more on this tape. Copy. No more on this tape. This is the end on this tape. Copy. No more on this tape. End. Copy. No more on this tape. There is something else on this tape. There is nothing else on this tape. The rest of this tape is blank. Copy. No more on this tape.
Right. Which way are you going?
I'm going home.
Okay.
This is the end of the third tape. Miss Thornton, so.